Hey there, everyone.
Welcome to the very first episode of the Social Impact Podcast from the Loeb Center. We're kicking things off with a conversation featuring Jenna Collins, an Amherst alum who's making waves in the world of legal services and affordable housing. We had a chat about her journey and the impact of her work. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the conversation.
I'm Jenna Collins. I am a housing attorney and the Director of Supervision and Professional Development at Community Legal Services in Philadelphia.
Wow, cool. Could you maybe explain what it is that you do?
Sure. So I will talk about both roles. So my role as a housing attorney, I do direct representation of low-income Philadelphians in housing-related cases. So that's evictions, that's habitability issues, like the roof is leaking or the heat's not working, tenants who are in public housing or other subsidized housing who are going to lose the financial assistance that they're getting for housing. I represent those tenants as well. I also do policy advocacy around housing. My policy advocacy focuses are the intersection of housing and domestic violence, housing and racial justice, and the preservation of affordable housing. So that's the housing attorney hat. Mm-hmm. And then as Director of Supervision and Professional Development, I am in charge of oversee and develop systems for our entire organization. So that's all 200 staff, every job category, around supervision, training, and professional development. I want to make sure my staff is happy and well-trained.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds like a lot to juggle.
It can be.
Yeah. So can you walk us through like what an average day for you would look like?
Sure. So I can talk about a day when I have court and a day without court. So a day with court, for housing court, there's two sessions. There's morning or afternoon sessions. So I will, usually if I'm in court, I'm representing more than one client in court. So I will go, let's say it's a morning court session. I will go to court. They basically do like a cattle call in Philadelphia housing court where they call all of the cases for the day and then they send everybody into another room to see if they can negotiate it. If you can't, you go to trial that day. So most of my cases, we're able to negotiate settlements. Sometimes we don't, and then we'll end up going to trial. We'll usually get a decision that day. Mm-hmm. I will say that like 95% of my cases are settled or we win. Have lost some cases. Those are heartbreakers always. So court, I'll probably be in court. There's a lot of standing around and waiting in court. So I'll probably be in court for a couple hours. Then from court, I will get back and I may check in with the staff that I supervise to see how their morning's been going. And that might be in person if we all happen to be in the office at the same time, but we're partly remote. So it might also be like over Teams or Slack or an email or a text, see what they have on tap for the day. Then I have usually a lot of meetings. And so those are meetings to, for example, provide support to a supervisor who's struggling with a supervisee or a supervisee who's struggling with a supervisor, to provide other managers at the organization support for their teams when they want to figure out a training question, they want to figure out a staff engagement question. I may meet with those managers, I may have a group meeting. I will usually have some meetings around the housing policy work that we do, depending on the day, depends on the policy work. I'm always available for any staff members to ask housing case questions to. And so sometimes that people will drop by my office in person. Sometimes it'll be an email or a call. We have clients who walk in for intake and I'll kind of be back up to help manage issues that come up on intake. That might need a manager to step in. So if somebody is particularly upset, if there's a really difficult case, something that happens a lot is someone will come in and they'll bring their friend, and we're not allowed to bring a friend back for an interview because that messes up attorney-client privilege. And so usually we'll need someone higher up to step in and like gently get the friend to wait in the waiting room. And then I will spend some time on my own, either, you know, working on policy advocacy stuff, working on casework, or kind of refining systems for the organization around supervision and training, developing new trainings, updating our supervision policies, that kind of thing.
Wow. What a day.
It's a full day.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you usually win your cases, which is amazing. Is there any specific case that you can remember that like particularly touched you in either, you know, a good way or something that was super difficult?
Yeah, I mean, so my policy work, some of it is at the intersection of housing and domestic violence. And I think those are always or often the most impactful and also most heartbreaking cases. So I can think of a good example of a housing case like that would be we have a client who she is being evicted from her housing. It's probably a single mom. She's being evicted from her housing. Probably it's subsidized housing, so the government is helping her pay her rent. She's particularly low income. She has a boyfriend or partner, ex or current, who was abusive, is abusive. She's called the police to the property. The abuser has done damage to the property, so she's being evicted for... It's called nuisance laws, which say that if you call the police to your home, you can get evicted for a nuisance law because having the police is a bother to your neighbors and to damage to the property, which is, you know, she's not responsible for the damage to the property. And we're basically disincentivizing women to call for emergency services when they are, or for anyone to call for emergency services when they're experiencing violence in their home. The good news is that there are some laws that are supposed to protect against evictions based on those grounds, but most people don't know that those laws exist. So that's where I come in. So I will, you know, you get to court. I try to make the case to a landlord, and sometimes they are sympathetic and sometimes they're not. If they're not, then we get in front of the judge and I get to present the law. Sometimes the judge doesn't even know the law existed.
Wow.
And... you know, keep my client and probably her kids, because again, it's mostly single moms, in housing that they desperately need because it is subsidized by the government and they are probably particularly low income, even though probably my client has a job. But when you have kids and you're making minimum wage, which is the state of Pennsylvania, $7.25 an hour,
yeah,
that is not enough to afford an apartment for you and your kids and all of the other things that you and your children need. So that is an actual example of a case, but also a typical example of a case that feels really important and meaningful because it's so individualized and it's the kind of thing that it's the protections are there, but people just don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where you can really benefit from the help of a lawyer or an organization like mine, is making sure that people know the protections that are out there for them, including the judges that we appear in front of.
Yeah, wow. On the flip side of that, do you have any, well, I guess not flip side, do you have any like kind of success stories that you are like really proud of and want to share?
Big success stories. I can think of policy advocacy successes. Yeah. It is not like just mine personally. It is really a collective effort of everyone that I work with in the housing unit at CLS. Mm-hmm. In the early 2010s, we really started doing a lot of work to push for a right to counsel in housing cases. Lots of people don't know. They think you're guaranteed a lawyer in any case, especially a case as important as one where you're about to lose your housing. Mm-hmm. You are not. So we did a lot of work and a lot of advocacy for a really long time with the Philadelphia City Council. We worked to get funding for studies to show the money that could be saved, to show the disparity in representation between landlords and tenants. And how beneficial it can be for a tenant to have a lawyer in the room, and how it's good for the city. It saves the city. It saves the taxpayers money. It decreases pressure on shelter systems, things like that, to have a lawyer in the room. And we were finally able in 2019 to get right to counsel in all housing cases passed in Philadelphia. And really it was supposed to start very shortly after in early 2020, but then COVID hit and courts closed. Mm-hmm. So it really started in earnest at at the end of the late fall of 2020, early 2021, and now we are representing clients in housing cases without a merit determination, with funding from the city of Philadelphia to hire enough lawyers, and slowly but surely we're rolling it out zip code by zip code, starting with the lowest income zip codes in Philadelphia and working our way up.
Wow. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Are you from Philadelphia?
I am not from Philadelphia. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, but I've been in Philly since 2011. So.
Oh, cool. How did you become interested in housing law?
I think I first really became interested in housing law actually when I was graduating Amherst in 08 and we had the foreclosure crisis hit, and we started to really see the impact that kind of extreme loss in housing stability had mm-hmm. on communities and individuals in the country. I'm from Cleveland originally, and Cleveland was one of the city's hardest hit by the foreclosure crisis, to the point where now you still see lots of blocks of vacant boarded up housing mm-hmm. that was homes that were foreclosed on during the foreclosure crisis back in, you know, 2008 to 2012 time period. So, you know, 10, 15 years, even more. So seeing the impact that had on communities, and then the way that it really touches every issue that I'm interested in, from, you know, the domestic violence work, the racial justice work, to climate justice, to barriers to employment, to criminal justice outcomes, just felt like it was an issue that basically touched everything.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about how current events, you know, the new administration might impact your work?
The new administration is having a huge impact on our work already, and it's been 6 weeks. You know, they are planning on decreasing the staffing at the Department of Housing and Urban Development by 50%. And this is, you know, it is the federal government department that basically handles discrimination claims in housing. Mm-hmm. It also administers all of the like subsidized low-income housing programs. Almost everyone in the country, in some way funnels through HUD. So that is huge, and we're not sure what's gonna happen there. It was already understaffed and underfunded. We've also already seen the beginning of rollback of civil rights protections. You know, on March 4th, the Trump administration instituted a regulation that would roll back an Obama-era rule that was meant to decrease segregation, which seems like it would be not controversial, right? Like, we all agree segregation is bad, right? Well, apparently not. So we're now dealing with, what do we do about this rollback and this rule? So there's that piece of us being on the defense with the federal government, but there's also now a turn towards really counting on local government and state government to pick up the slack and do a lot more advocacy on those levels to get policies in place, since we know right now we cannot count on the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how things develop.
It sure will.
Yeah. Do you ever become demoralized by your work?
I definitely have moments of feeling demoralized by my work. I will say that early in the first Trump administration, really feeling some of those feelings of hopelessness, of like, I can't believe this is happening. It feels a little bit different now, because it's like, well, we like, we've done this once before, so we have some sense of what we need to do going forward. So I think, yeah, when we see harmful policy changes, but things like the rollback of this rule that was supposed to decrease segregation, like, that can make you feel pretty hopeless when you're like, we really haven't settled that we think segregation is bad.
Yeah, 2025.
Right. And there's also just sometimes you look at like the incredible numbers of clients who need our help and just feel the weight of that system, mm-hmm. And the weight of poverty and injustice that can be really, really hard. And so I definitely have those moments, but I up until this point, have always come out the other side feeling energized and ready to work.
Wow. How do you re-energize yourself?
Lots of different ways. Sometimes it's just taking a break, right? It is like, whether that's actually taking a break from work, like going on vacation, taking a mental health day, that can be a piece of it. It can be changing the focus of my work a little bit. So maybe, you know, this policy issue this week feels way too heavy to deal with, so I'm going to turn to this one. Or directly representing clients in court this week feels really overwhelming, so I'm going to look at my policy work. Or sometimes directly representing clients in court, it's like you get like quick wins that way. And that can be a way to re-energize in the work. So that's a piece of it too. And also like leaning on friends and family and mental health supports, all of that is really, I think, integral to getting re-energized and staying in the work and not burning out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, as students about to enter the workforce, you know, I've heard, like, I see news articles that kind of bash Gen Z's work ethic, and I was wondering if you have any observations about if you have any Gen Z or coworkers who are recently graduated, just what do you observe about them?
Yeah, we actually have tons of Gen Z staff right now. We've done a lot of hiring recently, and I remember a few years ago when I realized we were like starting to hire Gen Z lawyers. I was like, how is Gen Z old enough to be lawyers? But you are. So we actually have tons of Gen Z staff, and I am not compelled by the arguments about the work ethic, like the lack of work ethic or the generalizations about work ethic for Gen Z. Or for, you know, being a millennial, the elder millennial that I am, the millennials before you. Mm-hmm. I don't see that. I do see, in a really positive way, a focus on making work livable, which I think is really important, especially doing work like I do. That to keep from burning out, work needs to feel livable. And you do need to get some joy from your work. I will also say that I have noticed a much bigger difference in work ethic based on people's class background, regardless of age, than I have on age. We have lots of like older staff who come from really wealthy families who are not as engaged in the work or not as devoted to the work. But people who maybe don't have that same safety net, like they really value their job. And just because they want their job to not be miserable doesn't mean they don't have a work ethic. So I don't subscribe to that view at all, that Gen Z is lazy or has less of a work ethic.
We all appreciate that. So I also wanted to ask, do you, what kinds of skills and like assets do you see as becoming most valuable, like in your workplace, maybe in the workforce generally today?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, and I think this is true since the 90s, like there's a continued emphasis on technology and being technologically savvy and understanding the changing technologies. I don't know what's going to happen with AI going forward. I am hoping that savviness with AI is not part of it. I have real complicated feelings about AI and what it does to artists and thinkers and also the environmental impact of AI. So I am hopeful that that is actually not a skill that people need to have. But I do think tech continues to be an important skill. I also think more and more, being relationship builders and thoughtful about people is a skill that is becoming more and more important in the workplace. I actually think really thanks to Gen Z and to some extent millennials as well, of a focus on workplaces as being people-centered and a little more worker-centered. I think we're, you know, no longer in the age of the like socially inept, you know, quote unquote genius, that we want smart people who work hard but are thoughtful of the people around them.
Wow. Yeah, that's ideal. Now, is there any advice that you have for students who might want to work in public interest law, or even, I guess, just as we're thinking about joining the workforce?
I think
you can. Sorry, I might actually repeat that.
Sure.
What advice do you have for students who are entering the workforce now?
I think the advice I have for students who are entering the workforce now, I think I have two pieces of advice that I hope don't sound too like schmoopy. I think stay hopeful and committed. I think this is actually a really hard time to be entering the workforce. I am really sympathetic to that based on when I was entering the workforce. I also think, and I know this isn't unusual, that you know, young people entering the workforce get a bad rap that I think is unearned. I actually think the changes that y'all are pushing for are amazing and important. So I think stay hopeful and stay committed. And I also will just reiterate the piece of like, think about the people around you, build relationships. The best thing you can do for your careers and probably for yourselves is build relationships.
Mm-hmm. And do you think Amherst has affected that view that you have?
I definitely think it has affected the view that I have, in as much as like the people that I met at Amherst have stayed with me and have been really important parts of my life. You know, I am still very good friends with like all of my college roommates. I lived in suites, so I had lots of roommates. And you know, they have really shown me how valuable having thoughtful, considerate people around you and to support you can be. So I think that's a huge part of it. I will also say, like, for as much as Amherst sometimes gets the rap as being like all about like esoteric thought, I think some of that is really important to be able to be a big picture thinker, to make connections that are maybe not obvious, I think is a skill that Amherst really does instill in its students. So I think that's the educational side. And then just like the relationships that I've taken away from Amherst have been so valuable to me.
Yeah. That's really nice to hear that you're still connected with people you met here.
Yeah.
So my last question is, how do you unwind after a long day at work?
I don't, because I have two small children. Oh. No, that's not true. So some of it is like, I am now a parent, so I hang out with my kids. And that, you know, requires a totally different part of my brain in some ways. And so there's that piece of it. But after the kids go to bed, I am an avid reader. I read mystery novels because they're very straightforward and a little brainless. And I watch a lot of TV, like an unhealthy, I famously have insomnia. So like when my whole house is hold is asleep, I'm awake with nothing to do. So I will stream anytime someone's like, have you seen that show or you should watch that? I'm like, I've already seen it. It's just a good way for me to turn my brain off and disconnect. So I think between reading and just watching too much television, exercise before I just had a baby in September. Before that, exercise was huge. Thank you. Now that I'm fully recovered, I'm back on the exercise train, and that is like that quick hit of endorphins is really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
My pleasure.
And we all appreciate your encouraging words. So thank you so much for sharing such helpful advice.
My pleasure.
That's a wrap on today's episode. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed this conversation, stay with us because there's plenty more coming your way from the Loeb Center. See you next time.